Welcome to this episode of the award-winning Best of the Left podcast. Border security around the world continues to take turns for the dark and dystopian as right-wing sentiment against migrants and refugees continues to escalate to the extreme. Sources providing our top takes today include Democracy Now!, It Could Happen Here!, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, the PBS NewsHour, and Your Undivided Attention. Then, in the additional deeper dive half of the show, there will be more on the politicization of the border, brutal border enforcement, the border industrial complex, and migrant stories.
For more, we're joined by Democratic Congressmember Delia Ramirez of Illinois, where it's estimated 1 in 10 children in the state has an undocumented parent. Ramirez is the first Latina congressmember to ever represent Illinois. She's also married to a DACA recipient who'd benefit from this new Biden executive action. On Tuesday, she and her husband, Boris Hernandez, attended Biden's White House announcement. Congressmember, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you explain in detail what exactly President Biden has now put into effect and how it affects your own personal family?
Yeah, I mean, Amy, it's an announcement that hits personally, right? I'm married to my amazing husband, Boris, who came at the age of 14, who is DACA, and we've been going through this process for about 3 years to adjust status. But here's the reality. There's an assumption that if you marry a U.S. citizen, you automatically become a U.S. citizen or a green card holder in this country. Most people don't understand that in order for you to be able to get permanent status here, you have to actually apply through a marriage adjustment status that requires, if you enter this country unauthorized, like you just heard from the southern border, for you to pay a 10-year bar back in your home country. So what that means is that if someone is married to a U.S. citizen, as a family, they want to stay together. The current law requires them to go back to their country with absolutely no guarantee that they will be approved to re-enter the country. Anything can happen in that time. And in some cases, people are waiting 10, 11, 12 years back in Mexico, in Haiti, Ecuador, or wherever their home country is. In essence, separating families, and which is why there are over 500,000 individuals made up of these households who are still in the shadows. On Tuesday, that changes that. It means that no longer will you have to go back to your home country in order to be able to go through your adjustment status. You will be able to stay with your family here and raise your children and apply for your legal permanent residency, as well as a 3-year work permit. It's major. It literally means keeping families together in mixed status. It means that U.S. citizens like me who are married to non-citizens won't have to worry that at any given time, if they're in their DACA, that the program ends and they'll be undocumented completely, or if they're not DACA, that at any moment in the shadows, they could be deported.
I want to ask you about the timing of this, both right before the presidential election debate between Biden and Trump, but also right after President Biden just issued one of the most restrictive immigration policies ever declared under a recent Democratic administration. It shuts down the U.S.-Mexico border, denies asylum to most migrants who don't cross into the U.S. via ports of entry, and limits total asylum requests at the southern border to no more than 2,500 per day. Can you talk about what he's done now and what he did just a few weeks ago?
Yeah. I mean, Amy, let's be honest. Two executive orders that could not be more different from each other. One of them is restricting people's ability to seek asylum in this country, which I have publicly denounced and I continue to denounce. I said to Secretary Mayorkas, this does not change the fact that that EO must be repealed as soon as possible. And then one, which is the one he should have done 2 weeks ago, which is giving an opportunity for families to stay together, helping dreamers particularly those that were not eligible through the timeline to be able to get DACA to finally get a professional visa. Two different things. One is about what our administration is doing about the southern border and actually reacting to Republicans, who, which, by the way, I have said, it doesn't matter what you do on border, and it doesn't matter how terrible you are or how great you are in immigration, Republicans will continue to attack Democrats on immigration because this is the number one issue that they are convinced will allow them to win the White House. And so I continue to say, be the administration that shows the stark difference between Donald Trump and Joe Biden as it pertains to immigration. Tuesday was a good step in that direction. What he did 2.5 weeks ago was not. And so I think we need to be very, very clear. We have to continue to allow people to seek asylum. It's a human right in this country. Amy, I was in Panama. I saw the worst of the worst situations. Women with children seeking asylum. Many of them have made it to our southern border, and they should be welcomed. We should provide resources. We should ensure that we're working with our neighbor countries to also extend protections. And people like me, or a woman who I just heard who is about to give birth to her child, who is undocumented, who has gone to school here, should be able to stay with her family. This system has been broken, Amy, since the 80s. And it's funny how Republicans continue to say, Biden is trying to extend through executive action amnesty. Last I checked, Reagan was Republican. And frankly, that's why my parents are U.S. citizens today.
Congressmember Delia Ramirez, you are also the co-sponsor of the American Families United Act. Can you explain what that would do?
Yeah. I mean, look, this is the comprehensive bill to be able to provide immigration reform. And that's actually, Amy, what we continue to work on. Tuesday was a great step forward. But Amy, let's be honest, there's so many people left behind. I knew, and it was mixed emotions, when we were at the announcement that there are a number of family members who don't fit this category. Frankly, Boris was happy, but if you really asked him directly, he was still sad. Because for him, it extends protections, but for Wesley Hernandez, his brother, who's DACA, married to a non-citizen, his status does not change. And the program ends tomorrow. He is left in limbo. My tio Chilano, he's still, after 34 years in this country, still left in the shadows. The bill, what it does, it actually provides expansive, comprehensive immigration reform, bringing the largest number of people into status. Many of them, most of them, unless they're children, contributing this country, paying taxes. It will provide them a pathway to legal permanent residency, therefore citizenship, work permits. And that is honestly the thing that we should continue to work on. But Amy, you and I both know that the Congress that I am in dehumanizes people that look like my husband, people like my tio Chilano. And we don't see Congress passing that bill this year. But we should be doing everything in our power to ensure that if we gain the majority, there's no BS excuses next time that we pass the bill.
Europe is no stranger to migration and migrants, and it is something that has been happening in waves over the past 3 to 4 decades. In the early 90s, there were multiple waves of migrants from Albania to other European countries. The main cause of this was the isolationist policies that were enforced by the communist regime that was in charge there. The unrest that followed at the end of the regime and the crisis of Kosovo. For those unaware, Kosovo had a war with Serbia for independence, and Kosovari people are largely ethnic Albanians with the same language. And because of this, it was easier for Albanians to merge with the Kosovari refugees and use that to migrate further and easier into Europe. Other waves are caused by other geopolitical events, such as the Jasmine Revolution in Tunisia, which I think Mia and Robert covered in their episode on self-immolation.
Yeah.
Okay. And much more known to everyone, the wars in Syria and Libya.
My interest in the border it has always run parallel to my interest in conflict and reporting on conflict. And like, it's just become such a recurrent experience to either learn about conflicts at the border here because somebody's telling me about them, or learn about often like repression of ethnic or national or religious minorities because someone here tells me about them, or to go somewhere. You know, I was in Syria in October, I was in Iraq, and then return and see people from there at our border. And like, as people will be aware, the asylum system, and we'll cover it later, the asylum system allows people who are in danger of persecution for various categories to apply for asylum. It's not functioning. It's not functioning in the EU. It's not functioning in the US. Like, I've seen that persecution with my own eyes and the consequences of it. And I've seen people try and get away from it. Every single time I'm in somewhere like that, people will ask me for help. And it is fucking heartbreaking to be like, yeah, the country that you see flying the F-16s or the F-35s over your head, the planes that cost more than this entire town makes in a year. No, we can't have a functioning fucking immigration system. Like, in the case of the US, it's this app which doesn't work and you can only use it north of Mexico City. And it's this broken system leads to people, they're not like getting on a boat across the Mediterranean, crossing the Darien Gap, walking across the mountains of northern Mexico because they want to have like a better iPhone. They're doing it because whatever the alternative is seems worse. And it's worth, people are fully aware that they're risking their lives on these journeys. It's not like they live without access to news and the internet. They know about the deaths in the Mediterranean. They know about the Darien Gap. When I talk to migrants who haven't crossed the gap, like I was talking to a group of Colombian migrants 2 or 3 days ago, and they were coming in to the US through, it's in an area east of Hukumba, which is very rugged and very mountainous. And they were coming into an open air detention site where Border Patrol holds them. And I was talking to them. I said, how many of you walked? How many of you flew? Most of them flew and then were able to walk forward. The ones who walked, everyone was like, oh shit, that's horrible. Like, you must have seen terrible things. Like, they're very aware of how dangerous these journeys are. The reason that they're taking them is because it seems like staying at home would be more dangerous.
Yeah, although I would like to add that it's not every migrant is a real refugee and not every migrant has to be a real refugee.
Yes.
At least as the definition was established in the 50s by a bunch of pretentious guys who kind of decided this is a good reason to migrate and all other reasons are not. At first I worked in Greece and that was mainly with people of like what are considered like objectively real or good refugees, like people from Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria. Whereas when I was working in Bosnia, it was mainly people from Morocco, Algeria, Pakistan. And a lack of opportunity can be a very good reason to move. I think most white people who moved to America did so because of that.
Yeah.
Not because they were imminently, you know, bombed in their home countries, but because they wanted to make something out of their lives and they didn't have opportunities at home. And I think this whole concept of refugee is meant to distinguish between good and bad reasons to move and good and bad people, migrants in the end. People can do really dangerous things for like giving their children a better life,
yeah,
even if their children are not in immediate danger. And the other thing I would like to stress is that I think the migration regime that we see today is very tightly connected to colonization and decolonization. For example, specifically in the Netherlands, Suriname was a Dutch colony. And one of the reasons why the Dutch government agreed with decolonization was because the Dutch society started to get worried about all the black people showing up. So, and the same, something similar happened with the independence war that Algeria fought against France. Mm-hmm. France preferred to give them independence rather than give them equal rights and access to the French territory. So lifting, like creating those barriers and keeping people in the global south after these countries became independent is very tightly connected with decolonization, but of course, especially with like neocolonization and new ways of controlling people in the global south and exploiting them.
Yeah. If we look at like the US context, the United States government has managed to engineer this sort of compromise where capital travels freely across the Americas and people don't, right? So it's possible for them to exploit lower wage labor, for U.S. companies to exploit lower wage labor in Mexico and other countries to the south, but not for those people to come and seek a better wage, a better way of living in the country that is consuming the products of their labor. And so like that this is obviously not new to people, right? This is a thing that Zapatistas highlighted in 1994, and it's been the case for 30 years. But yeah, we have in the US, because the United States did colonialism like kind of in a somewhat less overt way, although often in a pretty overt way, it's facilitated undemocratic regimes and a low quality of life for people all across, specifically the Americas, but also the rest of the world. And it's now seeking to prevent those people from coming here after it destabilized their countries, right? Or in the case of climate change, again, like the consumption habits of certain countries have had an impact on people all around the world, to include people in more dire economic circumstances. And it shouldn't be any less, we shouldn't like have any less empathy or solidarity with those people because no one's bombing them and they just want a chance for their kids to do the same shit. Like I moved to America when I was 21 because there weren't many jobs for me at home. Like
there's something very arrogant about thinking that you can decide whether someone else has a right to exist somewhere.
Totally.
And I think that's kind of what migration policies are.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, they were established after the Second World War with a very narrow set of categories. Like, not only do not include climate change, but also like generalized violence, right? The generalized violence.
Yeah, actually, fleeing from a war is not making you a real refugee according to international law.
Yeah,
which is something people don't know. So, like, an average Syrian refugee is actually legally not a refugee.
Right. Yeah,
they are fleeing indiscriminate violence, but not like they don't have like political. They don't have a right to political asylum.
Yeah, or like people in Ecuador will talk to people from Ecuador a lot, you know, and they'll be like, "Well, you've seen, man, they took over the TV station. So some gangs took over a TV station there recently, and it's kind of a armed takeover." And then, like as you can see, like, would you want your child growing up there? You know, if you had children, and of course, it's a very compelling argument. And if I was in their position with young children, one guy I met the other day, his son needed medical care that he couldn't obtain in his country. You know, like that's a perfectly valid reason for coming here, but none of those things count for asylum. So those people are either lumped into quote unquote economic migrants, which is still, you know, like people have a right to a living wage and to be able to pay for their family to have the things that they need to survive and thrive. But you're right, the asylum system is very narrow.
Our main story tonight concerns Europe. You know, that thing Belgium is in. If you've watched the news at all lately, you cannot have missed what has been happening there.
Europe's migrant crisis is getting worse by the day.
A migrant crisis spiraling out of control.
Hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers are risking everything.
A human wave washing over Europe's southern shores.
Hundreds of thousands of migrants have streamed into Europe, the largest influx there since the end of World War II.
Wow. The largest since the end of World War II. And remember, millions of people back then were searching both for a better life and for the booth where it was rumored you could slap dead Hitler. And look, the scale of this story can be hard to get your head around. Hundreds of thousands of people are on the move just within Europe, and another 4 million are being hosted in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. And when numbers get that high, they can be hard to comprehend. It's like when someone tells you the size of the audience of NCIS New Orleans. 17 million people? How's that even possible? How many Navy-based crimes could there possibly be in New Orleans? This doesn't make any sense. And when you are dealing with a mass of people that large, you really want to be a little careful with how you describe them. Unfortunately, David Cameron, noted alleged swine fellatio enthusiast, recently referred to a swarm of people coming across the Mediterranean. And that language matters, because a swarm of anything sounds terrifying, no matter what it is. If I hear there are a lot of kittens coming my way, I'm going to be delighted. But if I hear there is a swarm of kittens approaching, I'm grabbing a shotgun and I'm getting to high ground, because I'm not going to let those furry fuckers take me alive. And here in the US, Some in the media have chosen to reduce the migrant population to one simple stereotype.
A new video surfaces online showing why some are worried Europe is opening its doors to potential terrorists. Those are reportedly Muslim refugees on a train in Europe chanting Allah Akbar or God is great. Now, to be clear, we're not saying that any of those people are terrorists or in any way affiliated with a terror group, but it does highlight just how many of these refugees who are fleeing violence in Iraq and Syria are Muslim.
Okay. First, you don't get to claim that you're not calling those people terrorists when your lower third says terrorists inbound, ? If you are really not saying they're terrorists, maybe change that to something more accurate like people take train. Or some wear hats, others less so. And second, describing that as a new video that sheds light on the migrant crisis is a little misleading, because in researching this story, we found a version of that same video uploaded onto YouTube back in 2010, well before this migrant crisis even began. And if you are going to use misleading old footage to try and make people frightened of Muslims, why stop there? Just go the whole way and use a clip from True Lies.
Now, to be clear, we're not saying that any of those people are terrorists or in any way affiliated with a terror group, but it does highlight just how many of these refugees who are fleeing violence in Iraq and Syria are Muslim.
That's only about 10% more racist than what you did. So look, let's just take a step back, because for the record, these people are coming from many different countries and fleeing everything from civil war to economic stagnation. And while each story is unique, many of them are heartbreaking.
Nojin is 16 and from Kobane in Syria. Disabled from birth, she cannot walk and made the dangerous crossing from Turkey last week.
I've been trying many things for the first time during this journey, like a train and a ship. So I just enjoyed it.
You enjoyed it?
Yeah.
You're the first person I've met who said that.
But to understand why, you must know the world she escaped from.
Imagine you're 16 and you're always afraid to be dead at any minute.
What is your dream?
I'd love to be an astronaut, to go out and see and find an alien. Yes. So I want to meet the queen. Yes.
Oh, I think that girl absolutely deserves to meet an alien and the queen. And also, if she has time, a real human with feelings. But unfortunately for Nojin and so many like her, Europe has yet to create an effective system to process this influx of people. Every country has a different application process, and some are totally overwhelmed and underfunded. We actually got our hands on a couple of registration forms that were given to refugees upon arrival. This one was handed to a Syrian asylum seeker arriving in Greece on September the 5th. It tells him to return for registration on December the 21st. And that could be a tricky 3-month wait, because he's not allowed to work in that time. And yet that is nothing compared to this form given to an Iraqi refugee in Turkey, telling him to come back on June 15th of 2017. Which sounds bad before you notice the pink sticky note added at the bottom clarifying that his actual date will be February 19th, 2020. And that is ridiculous. These people can't go 5 years without working. They're refugees, not Renee Zellweger.
Risk death in the desert or drown at sea. Those are the terrible choices facing sub-Saharan Africans trying to reach Europe via Tunisia. 27 migrants are missing, feared dead, after their rubber dinghies capsized in rough seas south of the Italian island of Lampedusa this weekend. The Italian Coast Guard rescued 57 people and recovered the bodies of a young boy and a woman who succumbed to the waves before deliverance arrived. And this is the fate they were trying to avoid, being abandoned in the Sahara Desert, one of the most unforgiving places on Earth. Other sub-Saharan Africans with the same European dream have been dying of thirst after being dumped by the Tunisian authorities on the Libyan border. This mother and her small child are among the latest victims, lying next to an empty water bottle and not far from a man who also succumbed to extreme heat and dehydration.
Over 300 people are still currently trapped at the Tunisia-Libya border in the desert, and they've been trapped there for weeks.
Human Rights Watch researcher Lauren Siebert is an expert on the dangers facing migrants in Africa.
You have children, you have women, you have deaths that are increasing. You do have Libya border guards that are reporting deaths every few days.
Fatima Ibrahim from Nigeria is terrified as Libyan border guards approach. We won't hit you, says this officer, as he tells a colleague to give her water. We won't hit you. Don't be afraid. As the Libyans dispense the smallest of mouthfuls, Fatima Ibrahim explains why they're in peril.
In Tunisia, the police arrested us, beat us, and took our phones and all our money. They told us to go to Libya, and my people kept saying Libya is very bad. They left us without water and food. They put us there and then left.
Tunisia's authoritarian president, Kais Saied, is being blamed for what is turning into a 21st century pogrom. Accompanied by a jaunty soundtrack on his Facebook page, Saied presents himself as an international statesman, greeting leaders such as Italy's right-wing Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. But many critics condemn him as a dictator who propagates racism. In February, Saied told security forces to stop all illegal migration and expel those without documents.
We are African and we are proud to be Africans. We give help to those who come to us, but we refuse to be neither a pathway nor a land to settle in.
A campaign of arrests and expulsions created a wave of fear among sub-Saharan Africans and black Tunisians. Pro-refugee activists took to the streets of the capital, Tunis, to protest the new measures. But Saied was unrepentant.
We are being subjected to vicious campaigns from mercenaries, traitors, foreign agents, and shady parties. Today they want to change the demographic composition of Tunisia. It's a plot and they get paid for it. And they got paid in other fields to attack the state and the Tunisian people and their identity.
Saied's remarks have been widely condemned for provoking racial violence between Tunisians and migrants. The death of a Tunisian in July was one of the catalysts that led to the expulsions to the desert. Despite the clashes, European Union leaders had no qualms about visiting the presidential palace to do business with a man who seized power 2 years ago, crushing democratic aspirations of the nation where the Arab Spring began in 2011. The European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, pledged $100 million to help Tunisia police its own borders, with the lure of a further $1 billion in aid.
We need to crack down on criminal networks of smugglers and traffickers. They are exploiting human despair, and we have to break their reckless business model. So we will work with Tunisia on an anti-smuggling operational partnership.
The EU country which benefits most from this deal is Italy. The island of Lampedusa is just over 100 miles from Tunisia and has been a landing zone for tens of thousands of asylum seekers for years. Italy's Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, took office last autumn on an anti-migration platform.
The partnership with Tunisia has to be considered as a model for building new relations with North African neighbours. All these, a few months ago, would have been unthinkable. And I want to say it with a level of pride, but also with a level of gratitude to the European Union.
The rhetoric around this deal is a rhetoric of preventing people drowning, whereas everyone knows that the reality is about preventing people coming to Europe. That's the political priority in Europe.
Anand Menon is Professor of European Politics at King's College London.
Europe has cash, and North African states have space to build these camps to house these migrants. We should remember that, of course, the European Union paid Colonel Gaddafi way back in the sort of 2009, 2010 to do exactly the same thing, to make sure migrants didn't make the crossing. So politically, you see the rationale, but it makes the European Union complicit in human rights abuses in these camps.
What does this say about Europe?
I mean, what it says about Europe is that European and European politicians are terrified by migration from Africa and will do anything it takes to stop it, even if it means dealing with dictators such as in Tunisia. Black Lives
Matter! These people were rescued from the desert by Libyan authorities. Their protest took place during a media facility with a border guard unit.
Some people are sick. We ask them for a solution, no solution. Every day they come with weapon for us. We are not fighting. We are just a migrant.
Tunisia's actions are a welcome distraction for its neighbor, Libya, another country on the migrant trail with a dreadful reputation.
Our legal advisors who work with survivors of torture every day describe Libya as Armageddon. They describe it as complete hell on earth.
Natasha Tsangalidis is the Associate Director of Advocacy with Freedom from Torture, a British non-profit.
People experience such high levels of trauma and PTSD following their time in Libya, being subjected to open-air slave markets, being sold off at auctions, being subject to rape and torture.
But for human rights activists, discussions about the morality and cynicism of the European Union and its North African partners are taking second place to the issue of life and death in the Sahara. How do you see this ending?
Honestly, if the Tunisian government does not take action to save these individuals' lives by allowing humanitarian aid immediately to access the zone, and if it does not also facilitate the evacuation of these people, you're going to see extreme numbers of deaths. And you've got children there, more children could die. It's just really catastrophic.
So I figure maybe the place to start, in your book, you make this argument that borders take on a kind of laboratory role for surveillance technologies, that there's a kind of legal gray area. I know you were just in the Sonoran Desert in the U.S. southern border, and I'd love for you to take us there into your eyes, into your feet, into your ears. What did you see and hear about there? It's like, set the scene.
So you can rent a car, or in my case, I worked closely with a search and rescue group, and we went inside the desert to drive around, see a lot of this infrastructure firsthand. For example, there are AI towers, essentially fixed towers that you can drive to and see them firsthand, and they dot the Sonora Desert and kind of create this surveillance dragnet that ensnares people on the move. And you can also go to the wall, the infamous wall that's dominated our news cycle for many years now. And it's a beast to behold. I mean, it's there, it cuts across the land, it's rusty, and you can touch it and the rust will stay in your hand for the rest of the day, kind of like a reminder of its physicality and its violence. But one of my favorite kind of memories is that it also just kind of ends, you know, there's an end point to the wall and you can climb up this little hill and kind of pop your head over to the other side. Great reminder that borders are also socially constructed and arbitrary. But when it comes to the technology, it's really about these experimental projects that are being tested out on people that would just not happen in other spaces. And sometimes what helps me is to think about it as if we're tracing the journey of somebody who is on the move. So there's a class of technologies that you might be interacting with before you even cross a border. You might still be in your home country, and already you might be, you know, at risk of, for example, having your social media swept by a state and different data extracted from your kind of online profile and online activity. Governments are already extracting data from people on the move before they even move. There's all sorts of things that happen if you find yourself in a situation of a humanitarian emergency, perhaps in a refugee camp. That's where we're seeing a lot of biometric data being collected. So things like iris scanning, fingerprints, and other types of data like that. And also carceral type technologies too, you know, things that track people's movements, different types of surveillance. And then as we move closer to the border, that's where we see a lot of the kind of sharp edges of border surveillance.
Yeah, could you give us just a tour for listeners of some of the other technologies? I mean, you mentioned robo-dogs, you mentioned these AI surveillance towers.
I think in one of the more surreal moments of my career, and I've had many, in early 2022, the Department of Homeland Security announced that they're going to be rolling out robo-dogs in the Sonora Desert. So quadruped machines that you would see on something like a sci-fi show, like the Black Mirror, are now going to be joining this kind of global arsenal of technologies. So it really is important to pay attention to what's happening right on the ground. So the robo-dogs, drones, different blimps, different types of surveillance cameras, and even really kind of strange sci-fi type projects like, you know, sound cannons that are being rolled out to prevent people from even getting close to the border, and even AI lie detectors that the European Union has been testing out, for example. And then perhaps the last category is also technology that you might face once you've already arrived in a country. So things like voice printing for refugee status determinations, where there will be predictions made about your country of origin based on your accent. For example, visa algorithms that triage different applications and things like that. So it really is this kind of group of technologies that impacts movement at every single point of a person's journey.
So presumably this tech is meant to make the border more secure, making it easier and less painful or sort of costly to process. The surge in the number of migrations that are happening, the number of refugees moving around the world. What have governments said about why they're making these massive investments, and is that working?
So I think to this question, we can look at it two ways. And I want to bring it back to the US case in particular. The US government has been for years now saying that, you know, we need smart borders, we need new surveillance to deter people from coming and to strengthen the border and to kind of create a more functional border enforcement system. But the thing is, deterrence doesn't work. This is something that those of us who've been studying and working in migration for years have seen time and again. There are real reasons why people are forced to flee, and people don't stop coming. Instead, what happens, and this has been documented at the US-Mexico border by colleagues such as Jeffrey Boyce and Samuel Chambers, they've been doing really amazing quantitative analysis, counting the numbers of deaths, and they have nearly tripled after the introduction of smart border technology. So this is, I think, there is a failure in understanding human behavior and the kind of push and pull factors of migration that are inherent in why people make the choices they do. I think we sometimes forget how desperate people really are to seek safety. And the fact that they would put themselves at such risk really shows that there are real reasons why they are moving, right? And the other side to this is governments oftentimes say, well, you know, we need to make our immigration system more efficient, more fair, and therefore we need these technologies. I mean, I'm someone who used to practice refugee law, right? I've seen this system firsthand. I know it's not efficient. I know it's very slow. But the answer to a broken system isn't a band-aid solution that oftentimes also doesn't work. A lot of this technology doesn't work. It's highly discriminatory. Sometimes it happens behind closed doors where there's very little public scrutiny, either by journalists or human rights defenders. And so the fact that this is being introduced at such an alarming fast rate is something that I think we all need to pay attention to.
Like, you can map, and I'm not the first one to have made these maps, but you can look at Humane Borders in Arizona, and then you can look at EFF's map of fixed and mobile towers, and you can see people, and again, this is something I'm more familiar with than I'd like to be, people dying in the shade of the surveillance towers, without help, without water, without the very minor things that it would take for them not to have died. And so, yeah, this provides justification. It provides a massive outlet for the post-war on terror, like military-industrial complex, to continue to make its money and to continue to make its money through innocent people dying.
Yeah, I think it was either abolish Frontex or the Transnational Institute. I got some hands on some literature they were spreading, and there is a direct you can draw a direct line between like the end of the Cold War in the 90s with military-industrial complex having to find new ways to sell their products to states. And that's also why the border keeps getting more and more militarized, because it is the one point where they can still sell a lot of things without there having to be a war.
Yep.
Yeah, there's like a very serious lobby of companies who just want to make money out of making our borders deadly. And they're really successful, actually.
Yeah, I think they just want to make money, and they don't care if they make our borders deadly. Like the end goal is always profit for them, right? Like, and everything else is a consequence of that.
Think of the stockholders; they have to live as well.
Yeah.
What I personally find most troubling is this extension of the Iron Border into non-European countries. So the EU is making deals with countries in which, in exchange for large sums of money, that those countries are now containing or stopping migrants and refugees from ever leaving the Middle East or Africa. Like Rose said earlier, the Turkey deal is essentially a political deal between the EU and Turkey for Turkey to hold a portion of Syrian refugees over within their border to stop them from coming into Europe. And I think we paid more than a few billion probably for Turkey to do that. So the most prominent of these deals are, indeed, like as I said, Turkey, but also Tunisia and Libya. We're essentially outsourcing the abuse and human rights violations to countries that are outside the scope of our media, who have regimes that we would declare dictatorships and autocracies. In the case of Libya, it's even like rebels and warlords being funded with EU taxpayer money. Today, the EU pact with Libya has given rise to a full-fledged slave market run by cold-blooded human traffickers who, incentivized by the EU's crackdown on irregular migration and the resulting business downturn of would-be profitable passengers, are now auctioning economic migrants and refugees as slaves. We're just doing slavery with extra steps now. So to make it inescapably clear how bad the situation is, I'm now going to quote from an Amnesty International article from 2021. Tripoli's Shara al-Zawiya Center is a facility which was previously run by a non-affiliated militia and was recently integrated under the DCIM and designated for people in vulnerable situations. A DCIM is an acronym for Libya's Directorate for Combating Illegal Migration. It's essentially a department of their interior ministry. Former detainees from that facility said that guards raped women and some were coerced into sex in exchange for their release or for essentials such as clean water. Grace, a pseudonym, said she was heavily beaten for refusing to comply with such a demand. I told the guard no. He used a gun to knock me back. He used a leather soldier's shoe to kick me from my waist. Two young women at the facility attempted to commit suicide as a result of such abuse. Three women also said that two babies detained with their mothers after an attempted sea crossing had died in early 2021 after guards refused to transfer them to a hospital for a critical medical treatment. Amnesty International's report documents similar patterns of human rights violations, including severe beatings, sexual violence, extortion, forced labor, and inhuman conditions across seven DCIM centers in Libya. In Abu Issa Center in the city of Al-Zawiya, detainees reported being deprived of nutritious food to the point of starvation. End quote.
Yeah, Libya is just on a completely different level. Like we have systematic torture on almost all border crossings by European border guards, but Libya just manages to do worse than that and just systematically enslave, rape, murder, torture. And I think it's important to stress that like there's this Libyan Coast Guard. They're funded by the European Union. So the European Union will go out with drones, spot a boat of migrants. Previously, the European Union actually had rescue ships. But the European Union, if a boat is near another boat in distress, there's an obligation to rescue. And after the rescue, you have to bring the people to a safe port.
Yeah.
So having a boat at sea meant that the European border agency Frontex was obliged to rescue people at sea. And so they just thought, let's just do away with the boats and let's just have helicopters and drones. So we can still spot boats that are sinking, but we cannot help them. And instead,
they are not obligated to help anymore.
Yeah, I mean, they're physically. Yeah, exactly. They managed to escape that responsibility under maritime law. And then they paid the Libyan Coast Guard to rescue people, quote unquote. Libya is so bad that reportedly migrants just jump in the water if they see a Libyan Coast Guard because people prefer to drown than to be taken back to Libya. the Libyan Coast Guard takes the people on the boat, brings them back to Libyan mainland, and actually sells them to the militias running the detention centers. So the Libyan Coast Guard gets paid twice for stopping migrants, first by the European Union, and secondly by the militias that will later sell them as slaves or use them for slavery. And this is what we have been funding for years, and there have been extensive documentation about these human rights violations and the very direct link of the EU funding, and it just keeps going.
Yeah, the UN and other types of international organizations are a key player in the kind of ecosystem of power and innovation and border tech, because they're really powerful actors. They set the agenda and the norms around, again, kind of what we see as innovation and why we should be collecting more data. That's kind of a given. If you go to a lot of UN policy documents and different pronouncements, data is in there, right? We need more data. We need to collect more information. But what's tricky from a legal perspective and a governance perspective is that international organizations are this kind of third space, right? They're not a private sector company and they're not a state. So how do you regulate them? What kind of governance mechanisms exist? Oftentimes, it's kind of an in-house, you know, ethics statement, for example, on biometric data collection. This all sounds really kind of up there and theoretical, so I'll bring it to the ground, to the example you mentioned with Rohingya refugees. So Rohingya refugees have been escaping Myanmar for many years now and finding shelter or refuge in neighboring Bangladesh. The UN is active in Bangladesh and has been collecting data from refugees there, and it came out a couple years ago that they inadvertently took this collected data and shared it with the Myanmar government, the very government that the refugees were fleeing from. Now, if we are assuming that this is an accident, it's a pretty big one, because it's extremely sensitive personal information that often was also collected in situations that were maybe not totally driven by consent, right? Because the power dynamics are there. Can a refugee really opt out of data collection if they're in a camp that's administered by the United Nations, right? It's very different than you and I going to a grocery store and saying, oh, no, you know, I don't want to participate in the survey, or I don't want to give you my information because you can just go home. That's not the dynamic, right, that people on the move face. And the fact that the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees made such a big mistake is very telling. Because what's happening with other actors in the space? What kind of data retention practices do they have? Or data sharing practices too? You know, what is really happening? So much of it, again, happens in that kind of murky, opaque area that's very difficult to penetrate by journalists, by lawyers, by human rights monitors, because so much is done by third-party actors like international organizations that don't have to report in the same way that states do, or even the private sector does.
You know, if I'm a country, I would say there's going to be some kind of border arbitrage, that if I don't beef up my border, then refugees are going to be turned away from countries that have a beefier border, and they're just going to flow to me. So I really don't have a choice anyway. So I guess what would you say to them? And really what I'm looking for is, this is not a kind of binary answer. There's not a yes or no. This is like a way that we move. This is a verb. This is an adaptive process. And from your vantage point, what would be a better adaptive process? How would we be doing the process of deciding what is okay and what's not okay in a better way, acknowledging how fast everything is moving?
You know, maybe this seems, again, too simplistic, but it's about talking directly with people who are impacted by the technology and who are hurt by it. Because it is now, I would say, pretty robustly documented that border technology infringes on all sorts of human rights and has potentially even led to loss of life, right, at the U.S.-Mexico border. So if we know all of that, and then we also see this kind of race to the bottom that states are engaged in, I think that's absolutely right, of beefing up their borders, like really strengthening border security and not wanting to be the country that says, oh, well, okay, my doors are open. Like, what are the incentives there? I think we need to have a conversation about some no-go zones, frankly, when it comes to technology. I mean, we tried that with autonomous weapons, and that still hasn't happened, right? And that's really like the sharpest edge of this conversation. But yeah, what about robodogs? What about predictive analytics for border enforcement? What about data that's collected as part of a DNA sample? Are we actually okay with that as a society? And if not, then we really need to draw some red lines under this. A moratorium at the very least, but a ban actually, I think, is definitely something that needs to be explored. And I think it's a little short-sighted too, actually, on part of a lot of what sometimes we call receiving countries. So countries like the United States or Canada or the EU that have been historically, in the last few decades, the receiving point for people on the move. It's very short-sighted to see migrants and refugees as a threat, because a lot of people contribute very highly to countries that are their second home, right? And I think we've lost sight of that. Like the fact that everything's now weaponized against this kind of specter of migration is incredibly short-sighted. Because if we are going to be dealing with larger and larger numbers of people on the move in the future, it's actually an opportunity to think about, well, how do we uphold people's human rights? How do we actually function as a society that respects human dignity and wants to be a functional place where people can thrive and raise their children and contribute to local economies? That's really what we need to be talking about here.
I'm just curious, what, if any, are the bright spots or the bright people that you would point our attention to for where we get hints of like trailheads for hope?
Like we're going to have more climate refugees. We wish we could choose about this, but we can't. There's going to be more people on the move. And as you said, deterrence isn't going to work because it is a matter of life and death. And so we need examples of, you know, integration working better, refugee camps working better, and ways that technology can play a positive and helpful role in that. Is there any other examples of that you want to mention?
Sure. I mean, there's really inspiring practices when it comes to, for example, education technology and making sure that children in conflict zones are able to still learn when they're on the move or when they're in refugee camps. There's all sorts of really interesting projects out there that are kind of bringing the classroom to the child that's mobile. You know, other inspiring things that I can kind of think of are just ways, again, that, for example, you know, journalists are thinking about telling different stories and kind of focusing on technology as a way to level the playing field in the kind of vast power differential that we're talking about. And that's something that we're trying to do at the Refugee Law Lab, which is kind of my academic hat. My colleague, Sean Rehag, for example, he's more on the kind of data science side, but he's looking at, for example, using big data sets to crunch numbers and look at, for example, refugee decisions in Canada to create information for refugee lawyers to be better informed on how a particular judge might render their decision. Very, very helpful because, again, you're dealing with attorneys who might not have the same level of resources as a government lawyer might. So there are definitely bright spots when it comes to using technology as well to kind of meet in the middle and you know, work against the kind of differentials in power and privilege and even the kind of norm setting that it comes to, like who gets to innovate and why. We really need to find ways to kind of talk to each other more about this.
We've just heard clips starting with Democracy Now! Discussing DACA and the American Families United Act. It Could Happen Here looked at some of the history of migration waves into Europe. Last Week Tonight with John Oliver discussed the Islamophobia rampant in the language used to describe migrants headed to Europe. The PBS NewsHour reported on the harrowing trip to Europe from North Africa being attempted by desperate migrants. Your Undivided Attention drew the connection between border security and the spread of surveillance technologies. It Could Happen Here compared the tragedy inherent in the migrant experience with the profit of the border industrial complex, and Your Undivided Attention looked for new ways of thinking about how to manage borders. And those were just the top takes. There's a lot more in the deeper dive sections, but first, I need to kick off our summer sale membership and awareness drive. We make the show here because we think that it's the kind of show that needs to exist in the world. Hopefully you listen for a similar reason. But to keep the show going, we need to ask you for money every once in a while. And frankly, your help in spreading the word of the show. Podcasts like this one don't benefit from algorithmic recommendation engines the way shows do on video sharing and social media platforms. And this show just doesn't translate to YouTube as well as others. So that leaves us with the old-fashioned method of people who care enough about it, telling others about it. So on the money angle, we're offering a little incentive to sign up as a member this month with a discount offer. You can support the show and hear our full members-only bonus episodes along with ad-free regular episodes for 20% off. And if you sign up this month, you will lock in that price for as long as you keep your membership. As for spreading the word about the show, there couldn't be a better time as election season is swinging into full gear. This show is the antidote to the breathless barrage of up-to-the-minute updates that fill the 24-hour news cycle. We go deeper and on a broader range of topics than almost any other show, all while highlighting the great works of others that can turn into a sort of roadmap for anyone seeking further media recommendations. To me, that sounds like the kind of show more people should know about. And to help you with all this, I happened upon a reasonably good idea in an Ars Technica article recently titled, "Give Yourself a Day to Tackle All Your Recommendation and Subscription Guilt." And hopefully it won't take you a full day, but the underlying idea is pretty solid. The writer addresses the problem that so many of us have with the constant knowledge that there are independent creators out there who need and deserve our support, but we rarely take the time to give it. So to make that nebulous, scattershot set of thoughts about who you want to support that sort of comes to mind randomly more manageable, the writer recommends blocking out some time and knocking them out all at once. The article says, quote, "Declare a tech guilt absolution day, sit down, gather up the little computer and phone stuff you love that more people should know about, or free things totally worth a few bucks, and blitz through ratings, reviews, and donations. Poll your brain about the little phone, computer, and email things you like, and know could use a little boost." This could be a one-time donation, a Patreon or newsletter subscription, writing out a couple of nice sentiments about something more people should know about, or taking the 30 seconds to log in and rate something thumbs up or five stars. But then recognizing the issue with subscription fatigue, the writer also points out that this could be a time to reorganize priorities. Quote, "Subscription fatigue is real and little donations add up, so go ahead and make a budget for this exercise. You might consider checking your existing subscriptions and cycling the money from canceling one of them into something more relevant. I personally felt great turning the rest of the year's Hulu subscription into Patreon dollars for my favorite podcast." Very on point. I appreciated that. And then the writer concludes, based on their experience of setting aside a bit of time to tackle this task, critical to the survival of those of us struggling in the attention economy, that it really does make the process much more manageable. So if that sounds like something you've been meaning to do for a while, take this as your opportunity to support the creators you love and spread the word so that others can get the same value you do. To support us, just head to bestoftheleft.com/support and grab your discounted membership, and then tell someone about us. And now we'll continue with deeper dives on four topics. Next up, Section A, the politicization of the border. Section B, brutal border enforcement. Section C, the border industrial complex. And Section D, migrant stories.
I thought that a fun place to start today would be with Ronald Reagan.
He's always fun. Reagan's never not fun. It's, you know, when we lose things on such a massive scale and on such a scale of civil rights and human rights, it feels like it's also important to sometimes take a moment and just talk about, like, if we weren't fighting for just the basics, what the world could look like, and how, for example, if abortion wasn't so politicized in America, which, you know, Megan Burbag recently did a great job on our show explaining how suddenly that happened and who made it happen. Like, abortion could not just be a non-life-threatening experience in terms of the fear of, you know, being identified, being harassed, being in a clinic that gets bombed, but it could be nice. And people getting abortions deserve to be taken care of and pampered a little bit, you know, and have, what if you had a nice robe?
And I think this also means that our communities look different than they might if immigration was something that was easy or natural, or even, like you said, like having a nice experience of abortion. What if we provided a nice experience of immigration that didn't involve, like, being constantly threatened with deportation and miles of paperwork? What if instead you could like show up at a community center and have English classes taught by somebody who lived near you and have somebody be like, hey, don't go to that grocery store. That's the bad grocery store in the neighborhood. Come with me and we'll do our shopping at the good one. I'll show you, like, they have good deals on Tuesdays. So that's when I go. And just kind of have community and local welcoming and have richer, more interesting, more nuanced communities for all of us.
Oh my God. And so we're beginning with Reagan. I mean, I'm not surprised, but I am intrigued.
Yeah. During the Reagan administration, Congress passed and then Reagan signed into law a huge, huge undocumented person amnesty that would allow hundreds of thousands of undocumented people to get on the path to citizenship, which if you look at that from today's politics, if you think about what it would take for not just a Republican president, but like the Republican president to pass that kind of legislation today, like it feels unimaginable.
What do you make of that? Like, how does, when did you learn that? And what was your, what were the stages of grief you went through?
So I can't remember like exactly when I did, but it felt like a window into a different world. Like what could have happened? What could have changed so much that now the Republican like baseline argument is we should have a completely sealed border with no passage of people, just capital.
But I want to take Nancy to Tijuana for clams.
Exactly.
Sorry.
Reagan also, he had the amnesty, but I think on a lot of other immigration issues or like foreign policy that creates immigration issues was a much, much more complicated figure than just like, he said that people could be on a path to citizenship. So I think we should start by setting the stage, especially because so much of this like foreign policy that was going on during Reagan's time is like what is leading to, for example, the tremendous amount of Central American immigration that we have coming to the U.S. today.
And how much of that is Reagan's fault, actually, I bet?
So much of it.
Oh, God.
We had, as a country, had kind of been involved in Central America since the 1960s when we decided that communism was a thing that was happening there. But Reagan really like doubled down and a lot of those civil wars got notably worse in the 80s, I would say. The civil war in Guatemala began sort of including this wide-scale genocide of indigenous Mayan people who lived in the country. Thousands and thousands of people died at the hands of CIA-trained military. Reagan's support for the Contras in Nicaragua, I think, was one of his most direct interventions into the politics of one of these countries that didn't wasn't just like, we're going to support people. But basically, he armed and funded and trained a group of separatists to unseat an elected socialist government. The Salvadoran Civil War was going on at that time. Why were we so upset about communism that we were sending that much money and that much support? And why was this such a huge, huge deal as we were funding all of this? It just seems wild.
As Baby's sister explained in Dirty Dancing, the idea of the domino effect, and that if one country goes communist, all the others will fall, and eventually America and the world. And that's why we have to fund this horrible war. Yeah, these stories that forgive the sins that we commit in order to fight an imagined enemy never seem like enough.
Wars are very good at several things, but one of them is creating displaced people and refugees. And so kind of from the 1960s to the 1980s, we start seeing increasing numbers of people from the countries in which we are waging these sort of shadow wars through funding, through weapons, coming to the U.S. and becoming visible presences in and around the country. So a lot of Central American people, a lot of Vietnamese people are coming. I read some statistic at some point that before the Vietnam War started, there were like less than 100 Vietnamese people in the entire United States. And by the time it ended, there were a lot more than that.
Setting aside all the bigger questions about the idea of borders and the idea of countries and, you know, not to hand it to John Lennon, but just, you know, in a more finite sense, if you destroy someone's home, then I don't know, shouldn't you give them a new one? Isn't that your job at that point?
Yeah, it's people that are coming to the US because it's kind of seen as the last safe haven, the last line of safety. And we are in some cases giving people asylum, or in some cases sort of giving them other kinds of protected statuses that don't put them on a path to citizenship, but do ensure that they're not being deported, or we're just deporting people immediately.
Disturbing cell phone video appears to show migrants at the main refugee camp here being fed like a herd of caged animals in a holding pen.
It's a shocking video that has garnered attention from around the world. As waves of desperate migrants sprint from a holding camp in Hungary, a camerawoman appears to trip a man running with his child in his arms. The woman also kicks other migrants as they run, including a young girl. Now the camerawoman is out of a job.
Oh, I'm sorry, she lost her job. That's absolutely terrible. Don't worry, I'm sure she can find a new one on actualmonster.com. To be fair, she later apologized, saying, "I'm not a heartless, racist, children-kicking camera woman," which I can only presume means she's a loving, accepting, children-kicking camera woman, because the children-kicking part is not really up for debate anymore. And even those countries who are offering to take refugees are sometimes making those offers in the most insultingly selective way.
Slovakians saying that they're only going to give asylum to Christians. They don't want Muslims migrants coming into the country, Muslim asylum seekers, not least because they haven't got any mosques.
Oh, I'm sorry, Slovakia. You can't take Muslims in because you don't have any mosques. You do know you can build those, right? Mosques don't naturally occur in the wild due to erosion or particularly devout beavers. Muslims can live anywhere that other humans can live. Muslims are not like dolphins trying to resettle in Scottsdale, Arizona. And when refugees are not being excluded on the basis of religion, they're being accused of being lazy freeloaders. Just listen to one Polish MEP address the European Parliament.
If we abolished all benefits, then people who don't want to work and want to live from benefits wouldn't come to Poland and the rest of Europe. People who want to work are precious, however they are sent back, and we accept only those who don't want to work. It's ridiculous policy leading to invasion of human trash. Let us be clear, human trash, human garbage that doesn't want to work.
Human garbage? Those are some pretty strong words coming from the Polish Six Flags guy. And what he said is not just offensive, it's also wrong. Research has shown that while there is some small cost in the short term, eventually an influx of lower wage immigrants into a community tends to raise wages for everyone else. And a working paper published last year by four economists found that immigration benefited local populations in 19 of the 20 industrialized countries they studied. And think about that. Adding immigrants makes things better 19 times out of 20. That's a success rate matched only by Bacon and Paul Rudd. And incidentally, it's just a little hard to hear these migrants and refugees being called lazy, considering how hard many of them have worked to reach Europe in the first place. You really want to talk about lazy migrants? I'm a lazy migrant. I left a country by airplane, and the only things I was escaping were fog, public indifference, and an almost certain future as the turtle of Prince Harry's entourage. I didn't want to be Royal Turtle. I didn't want to be Royal Turtle. And the maddening thing here is Europe doesn't even need to do this for good reasons. It can do it for selfish ones, because as a continent, it is in dire need of new citizens.
According to the UN, the average woman needs to have 2.1 children to maintain the population of a developed country. But in the European Union, every single country is below that 2.1 level. By 2050, some countries like Greece, Portugal, and Germany will see their populations drop by double-digit percentages, according to Pew.
That's true. If Europe doesn't open its doors to more migrants, this is not the changing face of Europe they should be frightened of. This is. This one right here. And look, not every single asylum seeker is going to be the perfect economic wellspring. But instead of worrying about the hypothetical downside of letting these migrants in, countries should be more worried about the actual downside of turning them away, if for no other reason that you might miss out on someone like Najin, who seems like she would improve any country that would have her. Just listen to how she taught herself English.
How did you learn to speak such good English?
At home with my favorite TV show.
What's that?
It's Days of Our Lives with Sanini just struggle. Yeah, I love them both.
How can you not want this girl in your country? She loves Days of Our Lives. She loves it. She loves Days of Our Lives. And specifically, she loves EJ and Sammy. In fact, even after weeks of total hell, mortal danger, and inhumane treatment, Najin's biggest complaint is that the show actually killed off EJ, who was her favorite character.
The bill was widely considered a failure by the right because the first election after this happens, California extremely decisively flipped from a red state to a blue state. And everyone was like, it was those damn immigrants.
Because they've created a bunch of new voters who are going to vote Democrat. Is that why?
Yeah. And like, I really think that that is why, for example, a lot of like the stuff that Obama tried to get passed didn't work because they were all like, well, remember the amnesty in the 80s and how that went for us. And so
then they were like, never again.
Yeah. God. It like really poisoned it.
It is interesting that like the most you ever hear politicians saying anything about anyone Latino is the Latino vote. What about the vote? Is the vote okay? Is the vote ailing? How's the vote? Is he sick? Is he well? Is he struggling? Are we taking care of the vote? How's the vote doing? Does the vote need help? It's like, what about the people making the vote?
So that is Reagan's amnesty.
All right. They tried to do something. They decided they would never try it again, like me going to a Zumba class in 2012. Beautiful.
Oh, God. Yeah. So then up next, I kind of want to lump in Bush Sr. and Clinton into one little lump. Mm-hmm. Clinton's going to get his own section later, but I want to talk about NAFTA. So NAFTA is the North American Free Trade Alliance, and it is a trade partnership between us and Mexico and Canada. And Reagan came up with it, and Bush Sr. sort of negotiated all the fine points, and then Clinton got all the credit because he signed it into law.
Classic case.
I don't want to spend a ton of time on this. It's not explicitly immigration policy, but I think it did so much to change the way that we think about immigration in this country, and especially like immigration and labor stuff. And it also changed a lot of extremely basic things about how people lived in Mexico and the US. At the very basic level, if you are an economist, please don't email me. This is very, very basic. At the very basic level, NAFTA made it easier for money to flow back and forth across the border. So it made it easier for U.S. companies to set up the shop in Mexico. It made importing things like corn or pork or whatever for Mexico, or doing the growing of the corn and the pork in Mexico and bringing it to the U.S. a lot cheaper. And it made it much, much harder for small farmers and landowners to keep doing the work that they had been doing, because they were getting priced out of the economy anyways.
Because fuck farmers, am I right?
Fuck farmers. Fuck little farmers.
According to the American government. Yeah. Fuck farmers who aren't forced to use copyrighted seeds. We hate that.
The interesting thing is that this affected farmers on both sides of the border. So as big farmers are able, or big farm like conglomerates are able to start doing this work in the US and in Mexico, U.S. corn prices rise. It's great if you are growing like a million billion acres of corn a year. It is less cool if you are a small, diverse farmer in the U.S. who is trying to make a living. And so you have this kind of two-part shift. A lot of U.S. jobs are going to Mexico, and it's this very, very public, very visible, like, we are closing down this plant in Ohio. we are reopening it in like Reynosa or Matamoros or like a border city.
What a great way to create a sense of unity between two nations.
Exactly. And so I think you start seeing this feeling of like, oh, Mexicans are stealing our jobs.
If someone stole my TV from me and sold it to someone else, I would not call the new owner of it the thief. I would call them lucky. And I would call the person who took it from me responsible. If I see it as a family, it makes sense to me, right? Where if you see your employer, the company you work for, maybe that your parents worked for, as a parent figure, then it's like, it's harder to imagine a world where they're not in charge than it is to just blame someone who maybe feels more like a sibling. It's like we're, I don't know, it feels like the way that we are trained to see companies as caretakers, it's like we were so perfectly set up for this to be the next move.
You know, you think about like a mid-sized town in Ohio where the company is kind of the only game in town. You work there, your dad worked there, all your neighbors work there. Most of the people who are working a job are working in the same place. And then suddenly they close up shop and it feels a little like a divorced dad starting a new family. Yeah. And you're like,
and it's always the hot wife who gets blamed.
But also fuck those new kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and also like there are so many towns that exist because a company decided to build a factory there, right? Like that it's so much a part of our history that we just call them company towns. And it used to be so normal. It isn't anymore. And that, again, kind of by the same token, like if you destroy someone's home because of a war that you created where they lived, then you're responsible for them in the same way. I think that if your company created a plant, you know, in a town that then perhaps even sprang up around it where there was nothing before, because suddenly you had created jobs, you know, created a world and, you know, maybe an entire intentional community meant for these workers, then you can't just leave, you know, and a stockholder would say you can just leave. But
yeah,
but human ethics don't say that.
It seems like one of the ways to motivate public action to regulate this is to show how, you know, what starts at the border to deal with, quote unquote, the other and the immigration that's coming into the country, then later can get turned around to be used on our own citizens. And in your book, you actually have talking about how the global push to strengthen borders has gone hand in hand with a rise in far right politics to root out the other. And you talk about examples of far right governments who turn around and use the same technology tested at their border on their own citizens to start strengthening their regime. And you give examples, I think, in Kenya, Israel, Greece. Could you just elaborate on some of the examples? Because I think if people know where this goes, then it motivates how do we get ahead of this more?
Yeah, I think it's important to bring it back political context, because all around the world, we're seeing the rise of kind of anti-migrant far-right groups and parties making incursions into, you know, the political space. Sometimes in small ways and sometimes in major ways. And, you know, I think it's an open question what's going to happen in the United States this year, right? With the election that you guys have coming up. What I've seen, for example, in Greece is that parties that are very anti-migration normalize the need to bring in surveillance technology at the border and test it out in refugee camps, for example, and then say, okay, well, we're going to be using similar things by the police on the streets of Athens, for example. You know, in Kenya, similar things with normalization of just kind of data extraction for the purposes of digital ID are then used and weaponized against groups that already face marginalizations, like Somali Kenyans, Nubian community, and smaller groups like that. So again, I think the fact that there is this kind of global turn to the right and more of a fear-based kind of response to migration motivates more technology. And you again see this kind of in the incursion of the private sector, kind of normalizing some of these really sharp interventions and say, oh, well, you know what? We have your solution here. You are worried about migration and the other. Let's bring in this project. And then, oh, lo and behold, you can actually use it on, you know, protesters that you don't like or sports stadium fans who are too rowdy and you know, groups like that as well.
Okay, so we just talked about Kenya and Greece in the context of other governments. But what about Israel? What's their role in all this? Are they using these technologies at their borders?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Israel is definitely a nucleus in everything that we're talking about today. And I also felt compelled to go to the occupied West Bank for the book because it's really the epicenter of so much of the technology that is then exported for border enforcement in the EU and at the US-Mexico border, right? But what is really troubling in how Israel has been developing and deploying technology is that Palestine has become the ultimate testing ground, a laboratory, if you will. Surveillance technology is tested on Palestinians, both in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, and then sold to governments around the world for border enforcement. And all of these projects that are normalized in these situations then can get exported out into other jurisdictions.
Now entering Section B, Brutal Border Enforcement.
I found a very nice scholarly article that breaks down how the EU borders work and makes a very clear distinction between the different layers that protect Fortress Europe. These layers will be called the paper border, which largely consists of visa policies and similar bureaucracy that regulates movement to the EU and within it. Then we have the iron border, which is exactly what you imagine it to be. It's the physical structures and forms of control that we put up to keep people out. And then we have the post border, and that's about the reception of migrants, migrant shelters, and similar constructions that keep migrants and refugees ostracized and isolated, even after being allowed access into the EU and having started an asylum process. For those stories, we should turn to Rose when we get there, because she has much more on-the-ground experience than I have with this. So we'll start with the paper border. During the mid-80s, the EU started to propose and enact a series of treaties and policies that, in effect, strengthened the external borders and loosened the borders within Europe. I think no one is particularly interested in this series of treaties, so I will name the only one is the Schengen Treaty. This treaty essentially unites the external borders under EU command rather than as a task for individual states. In practice, this also means that EU citizens who have proper documentation can move freely between countries who have signed the Schengen Treaty. For holidays or work. Like, Rose, you and I, we could move to Germany tomorrow if we wanted to and have little to no obstacles in terms of like documentation.
Only if we're economically independent, though. Like, that is very crucial about EU. Yeah. EU freedom of movement is conditional on you making money.
Yeah, having enough money to support yourself. But you can move, like, yeah. This is very funny because it pissed off British people who were living in Spain, right, when they when Britain Brexited, because they hadn't realized that it would impact them. They you know, like, such is a common
difference. Yeah, they thought it was only the Polish that we, like the undesirable migrants, but they assumed themselves to be desirable,
Well, yeah, but I don't think we use the word expat, right? Like, Brits would use the word expat to describe a migrant from Britain to Spain. Like, it's ridiculous. I mean, I've lived in France, I've lived in Spain, I've lived in Belgium. And I was, I guess, somewhat economically independent, made 12,000 euros a year as a bike racer, but that was, you know, I could do that. It was very easy for me.
But it is, I do think it's important because I think it's one of those post-border things that what we see, for example, in the Netherlands is that most homeless people here are not the undocumented migrants. They are not the refugees or Dutch people, but they're EU migrants. So people have low paying jobs, break their legs, get kicked out of their houses, lose their jobs, and are not welcome in the homeless shelters because the Netherlands says, well, you are not economically independent anymore.
Yeah.
So this is also part of the migration regime, and this is also part of keeping migrants exploitable. Even if EU citizens have the right to work, they don't. They're only allowed to work. We only want them if they bring in economic profit, and right. We don't want them when they're sick or in need or whatever.
Yeah,
and then mostly we want them for jobs that we feel too good to actually do. When I was younger, I used to work in a greenhouse, and there's an immense amount of people from like Poland or other Eastern European countries coming there because Dutch people tend not to want to work in a greenhouse. It's one of those things.
It's an extension of that, like colonial perspective, right? That like we these are not jobs for us.
Exactly, because you get your hands dirty, and we can't have that here. to put the whole thing about the paper border into less academic term, the EU started to act like a nation state and started to make sharp distinctions between native and non-native European citizens. I think it's worth pointing out that what counts as EU is also a supposed European identity. It's very closely tied to geographical location and therefore also implicitly linked to Christianity. Countries that are largely non-Christian but connected to Europe tend to be excluded. Turkey is partially in Europe, but not part of the EU. And Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is a majority Muslim country, is also excluded from that. But much like Turkey is being tempted with the whole, maybe you can join if you do this and that, but we're not really committing to that. That, however, is a story for another time, maybe. The point that I want to make here is that the visa program for Europe is based on geographical discrimination. Countries outside the geography of Europe are blacklisted and cannot gain access to the papers that they need to legally enter the EU. This bureaucracy prohibits people from entering the EU before fences or border guards have even entered the equation. Hence, the paper border, since entering or crossing without a paper visa is nigh impossible.
Let's speak now to Hassan Ould Mukhtar, a researcher and consultant and the author of the forthcoming book, After Border Externalization, Migration, Race, and Labor in Mauritania. Hassan, it's good to have you on the program. Welcome to DW News Africa. Now, North African countries have been the main exit point for migrants going to Europe. So give us some context as to why or how West African countries like Mauritania have become major hubs as well.
Thanks for inviting me to be here. And I guess the context goes back to 2006, when for Mauritania, at least, departures increased quite significantly from the West African coasts to the Canary Islands. Upwards of 32,000 people arrived on the islands over the course of that year. And as a result of those arrivals, there have been a slew of measures, both militarized security measures on the part of European states and Spain in particular, and the European Union, in addition to more soft developmental measures like jobs at origin programs and youth employment programs, all with the aim of preventing people from leaving the coasts of West Africa to Europe. They have had various degrees of success over the years, but as the recent arrivals over the past couple of months and the latter half of 2023 in particular, as they indicate, there is as of yet little outright success in the prevention of those departures from West African countries, right, like Mauritania.
And just clarifying, so these people are both Mauritanians and people coming from other countries as well, using Mauritania as a route?
Yeah, that's correct. Right. Primarily people using Mauritania as a route.
And so you're saying that this deal between the EU and Mauritania will not achieve its aim?
Yes, in the immediate term, I think it might succeed in preventing departures, maritime departures, so from the coast of Mauritania to the Canary Islands. But I think the broader aim of preventing so-called irregular arrivals in Europe will not be achieved by this deal. I think people will continue to migrate through unauthorized channels, most likely through the border post between the Moroccan Western Sahara and Mauritania, and travel overland, that the routes will disperse in response to these kinds of deals. And I'm saying this just on the basis of what has happened in the region since 2006, when, as I mentioned, the initiative to kind of externalize migration controls to Mauritania and to other countries in the region was initiated.
And Hassan, if the EU were to still pursue this this plan, as it were, to cut down migration numbers, is there a better way it can collaborate with countries like Mauritania at achieving this?
Yeah, I think so. I think the first is vastly increasing the scope for legal migration into European territory. This is something that is promised within the deal. There is one aspect of it that calls for a increase in, I think, both student visas for Mauritanian nationals, in addition to, I think, circular migration schemes. But given that, as we said earlier, it's primarily not Mauritanian nationals who are trying to get from Mauritania to Europe, I'm not convinced as to how effective that particular measure will be, because it's essentially promising a certain and very limited, it must be said, degree of mobility for Mauritanian nationals to Europe in exchange for non-Mauritanian migrants who happen to be in Mauritania being policed and kept where they are. So I think vastly increasing the scope for legal migration and, of course, the scope for applying for asylum, for international protection across the EU, not just in Spain, would reduce the number of people migrating through illegal channels. It's been long argued in migration studies scholarship that a restriction in visas and avenues to migrate legally increases, as I said, the costs, financial and human costs of the journeys to Europe rather than stopping them. And it also, for those who do make it, it has the kind of perverse consequence of preventing them from going home, because it will be that much difficult to come back. So if it were the case that it were possible to migrate legally, there would be less of an incentive to stay in a European context or any destination context once one had arrived.
The next part is the iron border. This is very similar to what people already think of, but somehow worse. The iron border is a collection of fences, walls, barbed and razor wire, or even fortified enclaves such as Ceuta and Melilla in Spain. Sorry for butchering those names. It is both a deterrent and a performance. Like it's meant to project security for people within the walls. It shows that the EU uses an iron fist to protect Europeans from irregular or illegal migration. What is more important to highlight, it also makes for very good outrage media for right-wing and fascist platforms. Refugees will continue to breach those fences, and the photographs and videos of it make for very good propaganda about how borders need to be strengthened. The fenced borders of Europe have increased from 300 kilometers in 2014 to a shocking 2,048 kilometers in 2022.
Yeah,
that's...
Yeah. Substantially more than the US. We have, of course, it's America, so it's miles. But the most generous estimate based on pre-existing wall repairs, Trump wall building, is 748 miles. That was actually, I would say, about 750, because I've seen construction happening since then. So that's what, like 1,100 kilometers? It is, you know, we're just over half of what the EU has.
Okay.
And I think for me, like when I was at the physical borders, like the border walls, I mean, it feels like a military zone. Like I was on the Hungarian border, there's drones, there is super heavily weaponed soldiers walking around, like helicopters flying around. It's like, it's a very intimidating feeling. But if you talk to the people crossing the fence is kind of a joke. Like you can just go to a gardening shop and buy stairs or like a ladder and just put it over the fence. Yeah. You can buy a super simple scissor that you would use in the garden to cut your vegetables, and you can cut the fence open with it. People were building tunnels. Like, of course, it takes time to cross it, and it's so in that sense, it's a hindrance. But the entire promise that a wall will stop people is indeed, it's just a political game. And the politicians know that it's not true. It's just a way to show how tough they are and how rough they are. So most of the European borders are equipped with razor wire, and that is literally like knives wire, you know, like it is like, it's razors.
Yeah.
It's
little half razor blades.
Yeah. So the border in one hand is kind of useless, but at the same time, it is really built to be as cruel and as harmful as possible. And I know a lot of people with a lot of scars on their bodies just from those razor wires.
Yeah, like Elbit Technologies has massive multi-tens of million dollar contracts for border surveillance where I live. The razor wire that you mentioned is everywhere out here, right? It doesn't work. It gets cut eventually. It gets blankets thrown over it. But in the meantime, it hurts people. The wall itself, right? There's also walls between Israel and Palestine, between Kurdistan and Turkey. What they... at least these larger ones do is they force people. The US wall is also one that's entirely breachable. I've seen people climbing it. I've seen people climbing it this week. I've seen people go under it. I've seen people go through it. I've seen people go around it. But what it does tend to do is force people into the more remote areas where they didn't build wall. And those areas are where you're more likely to die. And every year that we've built more wall, we've seen more deaths. And as someone who engages in mutual aid, every year that they build more wall, we have to think about where will people go? How will they get there? What state will they be in? How can we make this journey less deadly? And that becomes harder and harder for us. We did a water drop on Sunday. It took us 5 hours to hike a very small section of this trail that people hike in order to surrender themselves, just as they would if they could come through a port of entry. But it's a lot more deadly now.
Yeah, I think that kind of sums up most migration policies or migration, like obstacles to migration in Europe as well. They don't actually stop migrants, but they do hurt them and they do push them into danger or actual deadly routes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you're never going to stop it, but you can use like quote unquote deterrence in the hopes that it'll slow down, but you're just going to get people hurt and killed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is like how incredibly cynical the border is, I think, that the main deterrence is the people dying, and that this is part of the political game to discourage migrants.
Next up, Section C, the border industrial complex.
Was our homeland insecure before 9/11? We just weren't worried about it?
Presumably. Yeah. So like immigration stuff used to be kind of spread across the Department of Justice and the Department of Labor and like sort of, you know, are immigrants involved with like the immigration justice system? Are they looking for jobs? Like what are they up to? And depending on that, we will put them in a specific department. And now it all sort of gets grouped up and put into the Department of Homeland Security and also given a ton more like enforcement responsibilities and funding. And so suddenly we get the existence of ICE, Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. And ICE was created to, quote, prevent acts of terrorism by targeting the people, money and materials that support terrorist and criminal activities, particularly as they were sort of like moving across borders. So like money laundering, terrorists moving across borders, things like that.
Mm-hmm. All these terrorists that suddenly were around.
Yeah. And so when ICE was funded, a lot of people were like, wait, what exactly are you doing? What's the point of this? To the point that in 2004, a year after the Heritage Foundation, which is well known for its support of organizations like ICE, we're like, why does this exist? And it's like main mission is covered by other organizations and other agencies. Let's just fold it into CBP, Customs and Border Protection. Mm-hmm. Like they're not really doing anything unique.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, we were like, oh, we'll just give them more money and they'll figure out what to do with it. And that is how we have the ICE of today.
Federal agencies always do better when they have a bigger sandbox to play in. Yeah. And everybody's so thrilled with how that's gone.
Yeah, no, it's been really, really successful.
If someone is like, I am a time traveler, what is ICE?
It's an enforcement agency, which basically just means that they're like immigration cops. Mm-hmm. They have this really loose mandate, which means that they run the detention centers where people are kept while they are, you know, sort of in the immigration process. They also do workplace raids. They also have been known to like go onto Greyhound buses and demand to see people's papers. They will serve out warrants to arrest people. Like, they're very in public life and in public spaces, kind of trying to catch out undocumented people, arrest them, and deport them. Every new president that has come in and kind of been like, oh, I guess I like run this organization, has tried to give them different kinds of parameters to operate under. Like, Obama was like, we're going to stop ICE from going after families. We're just going to make them go after people with criminal records. And then Trump was like, ICE gets to get deployed in sanctuary cities and liberal cities, and they get to do whatever they want there. They get to arrest everyone. They get to do racial profiling. I don't care. Or like, I do care and I want them to do more of it. Mm-hmm. And the way this happened relates to this funding question. So in 2009, Congress gives them funding that says you have to maintain a certain number of beds in immigration detention at all times.
Oh, God.
Doesn't matter if there's anyone in those beds. You just have to, like, we're paying for them. Mm-hmm. You should think about filling them. And suddenly, ICE goes, oh, okay. And those beds are partially in private detention centers, but they also contract with local, like, state and county jails. So the Freedom for Immigrants has this really great, like, interactive map where you can see whether your local county jail has an ICE contract and holds ICE detainees, and
wow,
where your closest ICE detention center is, because there is one in just about every state. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, they're responsible for all of these beds in jail, and they start filling them.
As one might imagine they would. It's
There's actually this really interesting, relatively recent report from Detention Watch Network called If You Build It, ICE Will Fill It. And it shows that whenever ICE opens up a new contract or gets like a new detention center in an area, the number of ICE arrests will go up in that area. If there's a new ICE detention center in your town, suddenly more people from your town will be going to fill that detention center.
Yeah, this is why we will never truly be able to learn about the world through narrative alone. Because not just the kind of stories that make it into like Netflix shows or biopics or, you know, pieces of fiction that everybody is telling you to watch or based on a true story, but like even the kind of journalism that makes it to you, right? Because newspapers run on circulation, or, you know, at this point they run on clicks. Like,
yeah,
nonfiction narrative is affected by this as well. The fact that the stories that really tell us, I think, the true depth of the problem are often infrastructural. And it comes down to stuff like this, stuff like, you know, prison contractors, right? The question of like, who is providing the meals for the people in the prisons and jails where you live. It's probably somebody who put in a very low bid and was therefore selected by the government because they promised to do it for a very low price, because nobody cares what inmates are eating because they don't vote and the people who care about them don't matter as far as voting is concerned. And so obviously the best way to save money is to treat them as if they're not human and potentially endanger their lives. And that's not going to work as a 2020 segment, right?
Yeah.
It's not thrilling enough. There isn't an easy to pick out hero or villain. It's just another wheel.
It strikes me that if I was a VC, I'd be looking at the UN's estimate that by 2050, there'd be 1.2 billion climate refugees and saying, oh, that's a great market. There's a huge incentive for me to invest. This border ecosystem is just going to grow. And so I'm curious right now, like, what are the actual, the companies that are in there? Let's dive a little bit into this, like, very perverse incentive.
For sure. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling the amount of companies that are involved. And some might be familiar to listeners. It's the big players like Palantir, Clearview AI, Airbus, Thales, actors like that. But what I found particularly disturbing is some of the small and medium-sized companies that kind of, you know, sneak under the radar, pun fully intended, you know, and are able to present these projects in a way that are seen as inevitable. There's one company in particular that comes to mind when you asked your question, and it was a company that was started by a 20-some-year-old tech bro in Silicon Valley, if I can put it this way. And he thought it would be a good idea to put a taser on a drone and then have this drone fly around the US-Mexico corridor, picking out people and tasing them and waiting for the border patrol to come.
Here's a clip from the demo video the company created when they were trying to market this.
When the drone detects an intruder, control of the drone is shifted to a human operator at a nearby border control office. Then, the controller pilots the aircraft down and interrogates the suspicious person.
Luckily, this didn't get rolled out in real life, but he got VC money for this. How can that happen? How is that even possible, right? Well, because it's lucrative and there are very few regulations that would prevent a company like this from operating.
Do you want to talk about why, you know, there's more latitude for trying on more of these kinds of things here versus, you know, Silicon Valley not being able to deploy robodogs in the streets of San Francisco or LA?
You know, I think a lot of this has to do with just the fact that we really are dealing with differences in lived experience. And I know that might sound a bit simplistic, but I do think it has a lot to do with the fact that the people who are thinking about and innovating and developing a lot of this technology oftentimes don't interact with the communities that it's hurting. You know, I sometimes, when I talk to the private sector, I like to go around the room and ask, you know, who's an engineer? A couple of hands go up. Who likes to code? A couple more hands go up. Who's ever been in a refugee camp? Not many hands. And I mean, I'm simplifying it a bit because, of course, there's diversity in the private sector space too. But what we're seeing is it breaks kind of along this power differential again. And when you don't regularly interact with people who are on the move, who might be refugees, or let's also broaden it out, who maybe have been victims of predictive policing or who have had to use an algorithm to see if they would be eligible for welfare. Again, it just becomes kind of divorced from the real life applicability of what is being done in the private sector for the sake of innovation and all of that. And I do think, you know, I mean, there are clearly projects and companies that are being weaponized against people on the move and people who are marginalized or in war and things like that, like the company we were talking about with the drone and taser. But I do think some of it is about just lived experience and not having those kind of connections and seeing what actually is happening beyond just the development and innovation phase. And we even see that kind of in these framings that are so common now, right? AI for good, tech for good, but good for who?
Yeah, I think I read in your book that the industry is projected to have a total of $68 billion by 2025. Do you want to give any other numbers about just the size of the fortunes that could be made here? I think the fact that this is just a huge growth industry is important for people to get.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've been seeing kind of this exponential rise of the border industrial complex. And $68 billion is, I think, just scratching the surface because we're, again, talking about a very lucrative market where not only do we have to pay attention to the kind of border enforcement companies, but also military companies who are now making incursions into that space. And so militarization of borders and using military type technology like robodogs and all sorts of different things that are also making their way there is also, again, kind of inflating these numbers. And the rise, not only just in the US, but also at the EU level and the international level, as we are seeing projected numbers of migration rise in the coming decades. That's kind of inevitable at this point, I think.
And finally, Section D, Migrant Stories.
It's a fundamental principle of international law that forbids a country receiving asylum seekers from returning them to a country in which there would be improbable danger of persecution based on race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or political opinion. That being said, I'm aware even like the Dutch government has sent like LGBTQI people back to countries where they could be like persecuted for that. So again, those rules seem to be very optional. So what follows now is two examples of border practices that I think are particularly egregious. So on October 3rd, 2022, Abdullah Mohammed, age 19, a Syrian refugee, attempted to cross the Bulgarian-Turkish border. After being pushed back by border guards, they threw stones at the border. I want to emphasize here, at the border itself, not at the guards.
Yeah.
After this, a shot rang, and Abdullah fell to the ground with a bullet lodged 1 centimeter away from his heart. He survived and was interviewed by Lighthouse Reports. He states that there was an intent to kill when he was shot. That's his belief. The bullet also pierced his hand, which is now partially paralyzed. There seems to be no justification or reason whatsoever for border guards to have shot or to have shot with live ammunition. This was the first time that such an incident was caught on video. If you want, you can find it linked on Lighthouse Reports attached to the article about this incident. The video is not as bad as you might think, but watch as your own at your own risk. As far as I'm aware, there have been similar rumors before, but this was the first incident that has entered like the public record, or the first time it was actually documented. Needless to say, no one should be shot for attempting to cross a border. I don't care about anyone's opinion or bad faith nuances. People have a right to apply for asylum, and as far as I'm concerned, this was a deliberate and calculated attempt at murder.
Yeah, I do think there have been quite a lot of videos of people being shot, and definitely people making statements about it and just having the actual bullet in their body to prove that it happened. Yeah, it happened in Croatia. It happened in Greece. Greece has a habit of shooting at boats as well, and in that way making people drown. Yeah, and of course, apart from the shootings, which I would say on the European borders that they are still kind of rare, the pushbacks and the violence and the torture is, yeah, the evidence of that is like an enormous pile. There's, when I was working in Bosnia, I think that was in 2018-19, there was no video footage of a pushback, and there was a journalist who volunteered with us for a while, and they were the first one to film it. But in the past years, there have been like many, many horrible videos of people being beaten up.
Yeah.
And actual torture.
Yeah. Of course, in the US, under the pretense of protecting us all from the coronavirus, which still killed millions of people in this country, we have something called Title 42, which allowed Border Patrol to quote-unquote repatriate people to Mexico, even if they weren't Mexican, and just drop them back in Mexico, to include laterally transferring them, which is a pseudonym for kind of trafficking them halfway across the country and then dumping them in a place where they have no connections, no money, and no way of establishing themselves, right? And this led to massively increased fatalities at the border, because people were trying to avoid Border Patrol rather than coming in and surrendering themselves for asylum, like as we see now, and massively increased encounters at the border. Encounters don't necessarily represent unique individuals, right? This is my, I will beat this fucking drum until I die. But apparently our colleagues at the New York Times haven't worked it out yet. Wall Street Journal, almost every NPR, every big outlet in the United States that kind of likes to commission border reporters who don't live on the border will tell you that like the number of migrants went up. When an encounter is an encounter. If someone crosses and then gets bounced into Mexico and then crosses again and does that 5 times, that's 5 encounters. It's the same person. BP doesn't keep records of unique individuals under Title 42, or didn't keep under Title 42. We don't know how many people, but we know that more people tried to cross. And we also know that every time you try to cross, you risk your life. And so we certainly know that more lives were put in danger because of this policy. Because again, like turning someone back is not going to stop them, especially when you're dropping them in a country where they don't want to be and where they're not from. Like the people aren't just going to be like, oh, okay, cool, I'll stay in Mexico. That has not historically been the case.
Yeah, we had exactly the same kind of juggling with numbers. I remember people in Bosnia, some of them would get pushed back like 40 or 50 times.
Damn.
And so they would be counted as individual stops.
Yes.
Indeed. So it would sound as if there was like, I don't know, tens of thousands. And I was like, it's really not that many though.
Yeah. We were saying the same thing.
They would just literally count the same person again and again and again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And also I would like to say that like, yes, it is a border, like the EU border countries, but it is also much deeper into the territory. So we externalize the border towards like Libya, Niger, and way further even, but we also internalize the border. So we would have people who had made it to Austria or Italy, and they would get caught in Austria or Italy, be pushed back to Slovenia, taken over by Slovenian police, brought to the Croatian border, taken over by Croatian police, often in Croatia, get tortured, and then be dumped on the Bosnian border, which would be the EU border as well. So this is what they call chain pushbacks. And I worked in Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is non-EU. So we would get the people after they had been pushed back. Yeah, the things that people have done, like border guards have done to migrants are, I don't know if you actually want to use this footage, but it's like, it's really, really gruesome. Like in Bosnia, there would be like snow for, like they have very long and very cold winters. They would take away people's shoes and socks and like make them walk for 5 hours on bare feet. So one of the main tasks of our volunteers, our medical volunteers, was amputating toes. People would come back with broken bones, broken skulls. People would be sent back with just their underwear at minus 20 degrees Celsius. I don't know how much that is in the US.
Lala grew up in Senegal and in Mauritania, where she has long dreamed of a better life. By the time she was 30, she'd saved enough to pay for a pirogue to take her from the capital Nouakchott to Spain's Canary Islands, and a future in the EU. It's hard for her to recount the ordeal she suffered.
There were all sorts of nationalities, Malians, Cameroonians, Nigerians, Mauritanians, Senegalese. The police themselves came to take us to the beach. The big boat to take you to Europe is waiting out at sea. Small boats come to pick you up and take 20 people on board, 20 people, 20 people. Not everyone could get on because there were so many of us, more than 100 or so people. Only 80 were lucky enough to get on. I've seen people who almost went mad. Sometimes people fought with each other, but the captains have big knives. They threaten you and tell you to shut up or they'll throw you on the beach. And they're not kidding.
But it wasn't to be. After 4 days at sea, drifting without fuel, they ended up on a beach in northern Mauritania. The foreign nationals will be deported, but Lala, as a Mauritanian, was simply released.
I haven't been able to sleep since I got back. When I sleep, I feel like I'm still in the boat that was rocking in the sea.
Ali knows all too well. He's a fisherman who has seen the hopeful and the desperate taking their leave by night. 50 migrants, he says, cramming themselves into a fishing boat designed for a crew of 6. And the sea knows little mercy.
Look, someone sent me this photo of a dead person. These are corpses. Look, there's a little baby here. It's such a powerful image.
Noadibu's port is full of pirogues, traditional fishing boats that the human traffickers have made into their business model. One smuggler wants to buy a pirogue for his next departure and agrees to tell us about the authorities and the restrictions. He, too, wants to conceal his identity.
The first one there is a police boat. The second is the Coast Guard. It's hard to get out of here illegally. Look at that pirogue there from Papafal. That's a big pirogue. You can put a lot of people in it, you saw it. For this kind of pirogue, there are controls to see if they're going fishing or for something else.
Mohammed arrived here 2 months ago. He is a welder by trade and has one aim, to reach Europe. As a day laborer, he earns the equivalent of 10 euros a day, which he spends on food, water, and somewhere to live.
You've seen the people here. We're looking for work. It's not easy. Morning and night, we come and work. We don't earn. I've been here 2 months. I work anywhere.
For Lala, too, despite everything she has suffered and the huge sums of money she has spent, she is still determined. She tells us that however horrible her memories are of being at sea, she would do it all again to get to Europe, where she hopes to earn a living. In this city of 140,000 inhabitants, more than 30,000 are like Lala and Mohammed, waiting to leave. But many find themselves trapped for months, even years, saving what little they earn to be able to afford a boat to Europe.
I'm sure you've heard this story before, but still, I think it's very much worth repeating. So, on June 14th, 2023, the Adriana, a ship on its way to Greece, capsized and subsequently sank. The boat allegedly had the capacity for about 400 people, but carried around 750. Of all those lives, 104 were saved. 82 were confirmed dead, and up to 500 are missing and presumed dead, the majority of which are women and children. I'll refer back to Lighthouse Reports, who did a reconstruction of the incident, which makes this even worse than it already is. Transcriptions and witness statements obtained by Lighthouse Reports, Der Spiegel, Monitor, SIRAJ, El Pias, Reporters United, and The Times strongly suggest that the Greek Coast Guard attempted to conceal their own involvement in this tragedy. 9 survivors were asked to make statements, none of which appeared to blame the Coast Guard. Different suggestions were given for the capsizing, blaming it on the age of the ship or the lack of life jackets. 4 of these statements contained near identical phrasing. It was later discovered that one of the translators was a Coast Guard himself. There were other translators, all of which were sworn in on that very day. Later in Greek courts, 6 of those 9 stated that the Coast Guard did in fact tow the boat before it went down. 2 survivors told Lighthouse Reports that certain parts of their testimony was omitted in the transcription. To clarify that a bit, because of what I said earlier, that migrants have to, are obligated to apply for asylum in the country in which they arrive, it's become a habit of like Coast Guard and Frontex to drag them to certain areas of water that are part of, for example, Italy or Greece. This particular one boat may have been an attempt to drag the boat to Italian waters, so the Greeks didn't have to take them in. So, to quote the report from Lighthouse, 16 out of the 17 survivors we spoke to set the Coast Guard attached a rope to the vessel and tried to tow it shortly before it capsized. Four also claimed that the Coast Guard was attempting to tow the boat to Italian waters, while four reported that the Coast Guard caused more deaths by circling around the boat after it capsized, making waves that caused the boat's carcass to sink. End quote. Not great bedtime stories, if you ask me.
Yeah, I think that's fucking horrible.
There's just no words. Like,
yeah, I got nothing to say. Like, I don't think anyone should be okay with that.
That's going to be it for today. As always, keep the comments coming in. I would love to hear your thoughts or questions about today's topic or anything else. You can leave a voicemail or send us a text at 202-999-3991 or simply email me to j@bestofleft.com. The additional sections of the show included clips from You're Wrong About, Last Week Tonight, Your Undivided Attention, It Could Happen Here, and DW News. Further details are in the show notes. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to Dion Clark and Aaron Clayton for their research work for the show and participation in our bonus episodes. Thanks to our transcriptionist quartet, Ken, Brian, Ben, and Andrew for their volunteer work helping put our transcripts together. Thanks to Amanda Hoffman for all of her work behind the scenes and her bonus show co-hosting. And thanks to those who already support the show by becoming a member or purchasing gift memberships. You can join them by signing up today at bestoftheleft.com/support or on our Patreon page, where memberships are currently 20% off for the month of July. Membership is how you get instant access to our incredibly good and often funny weekly bonus episodes, in addition to there being no ads and chapter markers in all of our regular episodes, all through your regular podcast player. You'll find that link in the show notes, along with a link to our Discord community, where you can also continue the discussion. So, coming to you from far outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, coming to you twice weekly, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show from bestoftheleft.com.